Regis Asset Trust versus Doval. I'll get a pronunciation on that. 2510-182 and 2510-189. Mr. Rubali here for the appellants. Do I have your name pronounced correctly?
Jody Rubali, Your Honor.
Very well. And Ms. Halloran here for the appellees.
Yes.
Whenever you're ready.
Yes. First of all, I'd like to focus on the fact that there are two proceedings here. The first is the general case, which is 08036 Aegis Asset Management LLC. That's the debtor general case. Then there's an adversary proceeding, which is against my clients, brought by the trustee. That's 0073, adversary. And those, when you want to approve a settlement, you do that on 9019 through the general case. But then there's also filings in the adversary case. In this situation, our complaint is on 225-21. Document 284 was filed in the general case by the trustee to approve a compromise. And he said the compromise was already reached in paragraph 5. And he attached a settlement agreement Exhibit A that was the compromise. That settlement agreement A was 10 pages long. The last three pages, 8 of 10, 9 of 10, and 10 of 10, had the 21 defendants in the 0073's names and signature blanks, but none of them were signed because my clients did not agree to the settlement. At the same time, the trustee, and he did not file a brief, he did not defend this case, filed in 0073, the adversary, a stipulation that he typed himself and put down that he uses paragraph I attest to the concurrence of this stipulation.
How much time passed between those two events? Because my total calculation gets me to about 19 months between when the settlement agreement was presented to when the order was entered. And I'm trying to understand, in that almost 2 years, where were your clients?
Okay, well, I get that, but I just want to first set what occurred.
Right, no, that, 20, I think that speaks that to date. Judge Newsom's point, is I think we've read.
On that date. Okay, record. So, but on that date, the important thing about this is the adversary proceeding is only between my clients and the trustee. It does not have the purchaser or anybody else in it, because it was an action to try to stay that those properties, that 68 properties, should belong to the estate. And the stip that was submitted said stipulation for final judgment to determine that they are properties of the estate. It did not have any signature or any block on it for William Saliba, who represented the trustees for the trust and the other specific people. And he's actually provided an affidavit that he was never contacted, he never agreed to sign any stipulation, his clients didn't agree with it. And he was the only one that had the right to represent his clients at the time.
Does that representation state also that he was never served? Because I thought in either the bankruptcy court or the district court specifically noted everybody who was electronically served regarding these documents, and those individuals are on it.
That's true, but what you've got to understand is what they were
served. So you were served, what to they answer were Judge Abudu's question, that's correct?
May I finish?
Answer my question. So you were served.
No, okay, wait a minute. Served, first of all, you're talking about 08036 in the general case or in the adversary proceeding?
I'm talking about the bankruptcy and then the district court's order stating specifically that the proper parties were served and therefore received notice that this was happening.
What was sent out was a motion to approve the trustee, that document I was talking about, Doc 284, that attached the settlement agreement with no signatures.
Okay, so that That was sent out, so you agree to that?
My clients agree there was no agreement.
Okay, and then between that time and the order, did your clients object?
They didn't understand there was an agreement. That's the problem. They thought there was no agreement.
So they did not object?
They did not object because they didn't even, Mr. Sliba didn't even appear because the settlement agreement that was being approved, they never signed. There didn't was any settlement agreement to approve. And the stipulation that they had to execute, see, this is the important thing, the stipulation that the trustee submitted that didn't have William Sliba's name on it, under the settlement agreement, it had to have all 21 parties sign it as well, because that was what was going to transfer the property over to, and the settlement agreement said they have to be signed simultaneously. What the settlement agreement said was, you have to sign the settlement agreement, and the 21 defendants, their names, they put their specific names that they have to sign. Then they, in paragraph 2, it says they also simultaneously have to sign the stipulation and then deliver the stipulation, like a deed, deliver it over to them. What happened was they didn't sign any of the documents at all. The motion should have never been set because under paragraph 3 of the settlement agreement, you don't set the motion to approve the compromise under 9019 until after everybody has signed the agreements. So what the trustee was doing was he was pushing to file a motion to approve in violation of the settlement agreement with no signatures. And not only no signatures, William Sliba specifically swore it, never even contacted him about that. Buddy Ford said later on, well, he didn't have my permission, but it didn't matter because the 21 defendants never signed it. So what you have is a situation where they're rushing to approve a compromise of an unsigned settlement agreement that we never agreed to, and a stipulation that was never executed.
But I don't think there's any debate that there's no signatures. The question is, as I understood the bankruptcy court and the district court, to be heavily relying on the fact that your client sat on their rights and waited months and months and months. What is your response to that?
That when I was in front of Judge McEwen, what she told me the dispute was that Buddy Ford signed the agreement and that under federal common law, that was a stipulation between the parties. And I tried to point out to her that, you know, under Florida law and both under the settlement agreement, it had to be signed by those individuals, and also William Sliba never signed anything. And then Buddy Ford told her I didn't sign either because there was no settlement agreement to sign the stip. Okay, so the problem is this. This thing, because they were only paying for less than secured creditors, they didn't pay the full creditor bills. The whole deal, in my opinion, was crazy. But how did my client's properties get transferred off with no signatures and with no approvals?
Can I ask you maybe a legal question? We've been talking about the facts for 8 minutes. Like, to what end? Let's assume everything you've said to this point is true. You've got a bunch of Rule 60 motions that the district court has denied, and you're trying to get that flipped. So into which bucket are you trying to put these now, the story that you're telling us? It entitles you to relief under 60 blank.
Oh, 60B4 and 60D3.
Okay, so with respect to B4, do you think you have a timeliness problem? You know, there's this case that the Supreme Court just decided.
Yes, that's true. It said, and in that case, what happened was they said there was a reasonable time limit, even on voidness, and they said 7 years was too long.
Well, I guess, right, the argument made there was the same thing that you've said about our pre-Coney Island precedent, which was you can make a 60B4 at any time. And the Supreme Court said, that's wrong. It was, I think, 6 or 7 years there. Yours isn't as bad here. But you haven't really made any argument about why.
Well,
your time lag is reasonable.
Okay.
You just said I could make the motion whenever I wanted to.
True, because at that time when I briefed this, that decision had not come out from the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right.
And the 11th Circuit was solidly that you had unlimited time. But I will say this, and I didn't get any briefing opportunity, in that these parties were in mediation for a very long period of time to try to straighten this out. There was a lot more problems than just this. The whole thing was a mess. There were secured creditors again that noticed they had to redo the 9019. There's so many things that took place in this during the time, because this is a real estate transaction. This isn't like a service of process issue like that one at the U.S. Supreme Court where the guy waits 7 years and got a judgment against him. This was a real estate transaction with these properties and all the stuff that was going on during the time period. Also, this case is completely different in the sense that we have trustee involvement in the entire transaction. The trustee created these documents and did this, and he's the officer of the court. That's how everything got rubber stamped. This was approved.
So going back to the rule 60B4, it says the court may relieve a party from an order if the judgment is void. And we have previously said in the Bainbridge case, a judgment is void under Rule 60B4 if it was rendered without jurisdiction of subject matter. I don't think that's your argument. Or the parties, or in a manner inconsistent with due process of law. Are you making a due process argument?
Due process.
Then that comes back to the point that Judge Abudu and I are making earlier, in that your client received notice. So what is the due process argument that you're making to fit this within 60?
Okay, he received no notice of the stipulation, Judge. It was what happens, Judge. Mr. Markham submitted a stipulation transferring. It says stipulation for order. Final judgment approving 68, and he taxed 68 properties. He just made that up, filed it, and then sent an ex parte order into the judge on 3-5 before the hearing and got it approved. My client's properties were literally transferred out from under him by the person who had to talk the defendants into signing to give them the documents, to give them the deeds. You see what I'm saying, Your Honor? In other words, they had their properties taken out from underneath them by a phony stipulation made up by the trustee's attorney. And nobody's disputed that. They're not here at fighting this. Mr. Sleeve has written a very detailed affidavit about the situation. There's no doubt that this properties were transferred, 68 properties, on a unilateral stipulation, not a stipulation made between the parties, not signed with the 21, in page one of the settlement agreement, it says who has to sign it. It's 21 people. 21 entities that were defendants in 73. Her clients have nothing to do with it. They were literally transferred out from under them and given to them with no due process.
Okay, I think we've got your argument. You've got some rebuttal time coming. Let's hear from the
Thank you, Your Honor.
The other side. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Patty Halloran. I represent the appellees who are the purchasers of the properties from the bankruptcy estate. I need to make one thing clear for the court up front. My clients were permitted to intervene in the fraudulent transfer adversary proceeding upon the filing, after the filing of the Rule 60 motion for relief, because my client's interest would be directly affected by any resolution of that motion. We're here today because the appellants decided 19 months after the fact that they didn't like the deal. And the arguments raised by appellant counsel might have carried the day had there been a timely appeal, but there wasn't. Neither the order approving the stipulation or the final judgment in the fraudulent transfer adversary proceeding, nor the sale order in the Chapter 7 case were appealed. They were not stayed. And based on the finality of those orders, my clients concluded the transaction with the trustee. And I would like to remind the court that the sale order specifically found that the properties recovered through the fraudulent transfer adversary were deemed to be properties of the bankruptcy estate, regardless of how their title appeared in the public record, that the trustee had the power and authority and was directed to sell the properties, and it approved my clients as the purchasers.
But you have a provision in the settlement agreement that says everyone has to sign, and we don't have everyone's signature here. So if we can put aside the timeliness issue of their challenge, why isn't that enough to say that there's a problem here?
Because, Your Honor, they're challenging an agreement, but we're here on the appeal of orders granting judgment on the pleadings. So we're here for the court to determine the appropriateness of the bankruptcy court's entry of judgment in my client's favor when they're seeking relief after the fact. They're seeking to void orders. The fact that there might be an unsupported or unenforceable agreement does not impact the validity and the efficacy of the orders entered by the bankruptcy court.
But those orders result in enforcing an agreement that didn't check off the boxes, specifically didn't get all the signatures. So maybe we can segregate it. I'm just trying to understand the pathway to get there, especially in the event that if indeed a fraud had occurred upon the court, does that mean there's just no resolution?
Your Honor, I think I can answer that by saying if this court assumes everything alleged by the appellants is correct and provides them every possible positive inference therefrom, they don't rise to the level of void under 60B4. They don't rise to the level of extraordinary circumstances under Rule 60B6, nor do they arise to the fraud on the court under 60D3, because everything that happened was filed on the record, was served on all counsel of record, and in the case of the final judgment in the adversary proceeding and the sale order in the Chapter 7 case, were served by U.S. mail on all creditors and parties in interest, which would include the defendants in the fraudulent transfer adversary, the appellants herein. They had notice and an opportunity at every stage to appear and object. It was not done. Mr. Saliba received all the appropriate documents by CMECF. He received the stipulation, the order, and the final judgment in the adversary proceeding. He received the motion to approve the compromise, which we have called the sale order, in the Chapter 7 case. He received all of those orders. The motion, the sale motion in the Chapter 7 case, included in bold-faced type in two places on the face of the motion, the notice of hearing. Mr. Saliba never filed an objection. He didn't appear at the hearing. One of the attorneys for the appellants, Mr. Ford, appeared at the hearing and did not raise an objection to the approval of the compromise, to the sale of the properties. And I think we are instructed by the United States Supreme Court decision in United AIDS Funds versus Espinoza that a Rule 60B4 motion is not a substitute for a timely appeal.
And with regard to 60D3, again, that's fraud on the court, which has very specific requirements. To the extent that the appellant is alleging that there is some fraud by the opposing party, wouldn't that be appropriately remedied under 60B3? And am I correct that the time limitation for bringing a 60B3 motion had passed at the time of filing?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree. That there's case law cited in the briefs that states that an incompletely executed stipulation, an unauthorized representation, perjury, anything that is fraud between the parties does not rise to the level of fraud on the court, which is 60D3. And there is nothing in the record in this case that shows that there is something done by either counsel for the trustee, by the trustee's counsel, or by the purchasers or their counsel that interfered with the court performing its responsibility to
impartially. Because the court could see perfectly well what the settlement agreement looked like and who did or did not sign it, right? There's no fraud upon the court.
That's correct, Your Honor. And furthermore, while the appellants dispute the authenticity, the appropriateness of filing the signatures, signature pages for the 21 defendants to the adversary proceeding were filed some 10 days before the hearing to approve the compromise and authorize the sale of the properties.
So then that means that the bankruptcy court didn't just proceed even with a settlement agreement that didn't have signatures. You're saying that was cured in any event?
It was cured in any event, Your Honor. And again, we have case law cited that you can enforce an oral settlement agreement if the terms are there, that applying signatures to a settlement agreement is really just an administrative act. And if the parties are aware of the terms and conditions if they indicate their intent to settle. And I think the lack of any objection at any time during the case is clear indication of the intent to settle. And it was only 19 months later, after the orders were final, after my client expended more than $5 million to acquire the properties and has since, for the term of this dispute, paid the cost of carrying the properties, that it's clear that they didn't, that there was no objection, that they changed their mind. And they want this court to reward them for sleeping on their rights and for changing their mind. You know, you made an agreement. In hindsight, you don't like it. At this point, you have no option because the agreement's been approved and it's by an order that is final and non-appealable. If the court has nothing else.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Mr. Rabali, you've got 5 minutes rebuttal time remaining.
Yes. First of all, the trustee's not here to answer the hard questions, and they're very hard questions. First of all, counsel represents the buyer. The buyer closed on this transaction knowing that there was no signed settlement agreement and no signed stipulation, because they were hoping they could try to just get these properties regardless of whether or not the persons want to sell them. The settlement agreement itself has very strict requirements in it. Not one of them were followed. It required execution of the 21 parties, both on the stipulation and the settlement agreement, and it named the specific parties. Her clients aren't anywhere on that. They knew buying it that the trustee didn't own this property. They couldn't convey it. The property belonged to my clients. And the only way they could get it is if my clients agreed to give it to them. They never did. She talks about settlement agreement papers being filed a few days before the hearing, which is totally contrary to the way the procedure was supposed to work. In the settlement agreement, it was supposed to be an agreement reached by all parties, a stipulation executed, and then 5 days after that, a motion made to approve it. Instead, the trustee, who's an officer of the court, that's why it's fraud on the court. It's not ordinary fraud. You brought up a good point, Judge. But we're talking here about a trustee. That's why I got all this deference. The trustee's attorney submitted these papers. The trustee's attorney ran through the stip. And, of course, the judge just signed it, order approving the stip. The hearing she's talking about, there was no discussion about it. It was just, well, if you guys agree to it, basically, okay, I'll sign off on this deal. Even though her client should have never got this to begin with, because he wasn't even paying the amount of secured debt. He was paying $4 or $5 million for $6 million worth of secured debt. His trustee was getting a big commission out of it. He was getting a piece of property without paying the owner a penny. Okay, so, but I want to go back to what was filed. She says, oh, the pages were filed to the settlement agreement. What Mr. Markham did was he took another settlement agreement with different page numbers. You can look. One is 8 of 9, 9 of 9, and 10 of 9. But the ones that are attached to the motion are 8 of 10, 9 of 10, 10 of 10. In other words,
perhaps I missed it in your opening. I just would appreciate an understanding in terms of the timeliness. What response do you have to the fact that it took 18 months for us to get here? That there was no objection despite the repeated notices that were sent out.
There were objections to everything by a lot of people, and there were new compromises made, and the parties were directed to mediation, which they spent 18 months mediating and reached all kinds of agreements, but they didn't reach one with my client. Finally, he got fed up and on October 24th filed his affidavit saying, look, there is no deal. And even before they closed, they said, oh, please hold off on everything before you start objecting. So my client's attorney writes a letter back saying, okay, please don't close. There's some changes we need to make to this agreement to try to make this thing work out, et cetera, et cetera. They go ahead and close anyway. That's the kind of stuff that's going on here. But everyone seems to forget, this is a real estate transaction. There is a settlement agreement which has to be followed. The number of notices isn't important in what you get. It's what the notices say. A notice that says we're going to have a hearing on a settlement agreement that the client knows he didn't sign and that can't even be set up for 9019 is obviously not going to go forward. because it shouldn't, anyone could look and see there's no signatures. So he takes these three pages, which he can't do, 4 or 5 days before the hearing from another agreement, lifts them, put them down. To this day, you know, there's no settlement agreement. We have $15 million worth of property, $20 million worth of property transferred, and we don't have a single document that says, here's the deal these people cut. We don't have a single stipulation signed by even all the attorneys or even the 21 defendants who had to sign it under the agreement. And all of this was discussed and litigated, and I just do not believe that the time limitation we're talking about, definitely the time we're talking about, because there were still things being handled, going to mediation, that should be a limiting factor when you have literally transferred people's property through a person who had no, through a stip that they had no authority to sign or make up. I mean, and settlement agreement with no signatures on it. And they didn't follow the settlement either. It isn't just that they didn't have signatures. There isn't, I could go down them and tell you every rule is in the briefs of what they violated in that settlement agreement. They didn't follow any of it. They didn't follow the notice they were supposed to give to have it, to set it for a motion. They are trying to pretend they could alter it without a written agreement signed by both parties. They are trying to pretend they can do a stip without even signatures when paragraph 2 says all 21 defendants must execute. And it defines who the defendants are. There isn't one part of that settlement agreement that was followed that they got this done for. And what's happened is the trustee who can sit there and tell you, okay, yeah, I made that thing up. I didn't put William Sleeman's name on it. I didn't get his permission. He didn't contact me, but I certified that he did. I don't have the signatures. Okay, so they can get a walk away with this because he doesn't answer. I say he's abandoned his position. Our dispute was only with him. He's the only one that sued us. He's the only one we had a settlement agreement with. I don't understand how the buyer suddenly jumps in and defends the trustee for whatever he did with us when they know darn well the trustee didn't own the property. We did. They had to get the property from us before they could sell it to their client. Your client jumped over. Thank you.
Very well. All right. Thank you both. That case is submitted, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.
All right.